In another century, when I was a child, I lived in a neighborhood that was abundant with children and abundant with pine trees. Naturally, lots of pine trees meant lots of pine cones. And I expect you won't be surprised to hear that one of the favorite recreational activities of the big boys in my neighborhood was pine cone fights. The big boys weren't all that big in objective terms, but when you are 6, 7 years old, even 2 years in age can make a huge difference. The pine cone fights disturb me for many reasons. Of course, all of you that are my generation must realize that pine cones are one of those things that can put your eye out. I never knew or heard of a child whose eye got put out by anything any other child ever did. And yet, in the 50s, you couldn't turn around without something being there that was going to put your eye out. It was an ever-lurking danger. We don't hear that anymore. Do you hear children saying that, or even parents saying that? But anyway, I was worried that somebody was going to lose an eye from a flying pine cone. But more than anything, I was worried a pine cone was going to hit me. I was opposed to violence in all its forms, even when I was a child. And besides that, I was a chicken. So if a pine cone fight started up in a yard where I was playing, I went home. But if a pine cone fight started up in my yard, I had no recourse except futile objection. "Quit it!" I would yell, usually at my brother, and he would always respond, "You can't tell me what to do. It's a free country." My post-World War II neighborhood was made up of young families with fathers who were ex-GIs. And it startles me now as an adult to realize how short a time had passed between the end of their military service and the births of their children. Our childhood awareness of our identity as citizens of a free country must have been absorbed by osmosis from our parents, whose lives had so recently been shaped by a war. I'm not sure how to explain it. I simply know that we were constantly telling each other it's a free country whenever one child tried to guide another child in any way. I don't hear that today the way we used to hear it in the 50s. Of course, we were right. It is a free country. And yet I knew, even as a small child, that being a free country did not mean that you got to throw pine cones at somebody. I knew that being a free country did not give you the right to mess up somebody else's fort, or ride somebody else's bicycle without their permission, or call somebody else an ugly name. Living in a free country was a lucky situation, and we knew that, even as we knew somehow or another that we used that phrase inappropriately. Living in a free country did not mean you could do anything you wanted. What are we free from in our denomination, and what are we free for? Of course, I can't speak for all Unitarian Universalists, but I can say with confidence that the ones I know, or the ones I've had contact with over the years, we are free from the obligation to figure out day to day how we're going to survive. We have all the food we need, and then some. We have shelter that ranges from comfortable to luxurious, and many of us have more than one place that we can call home. We are cool in the summer and warm in the winter. We have excellent transportation available to us anytime we want. We have vast choices when it comes to the style and comfort of our clothes. In these respects, we are certainly privileged people. Our privilege was made clear to me not long ago on the way to my second job in Richmond. I began to notice a little stash of what I would call junk piling up on the sidewalk under the shelter of this overpass that I drove under. I kept my eyes on the stuff every day as I went by. Never could figure out what it was specifically. Of course, I was driving. I couldn't slow down and examine it, really. But I watched as the pile grew day by day. Lots of boxes, evidently. One day a lawn chair, the frame of a lawn chair, no cushion, but this lawn chair frame showed up. Shopping cart and lots of covers of some sort, tarps or blankets or something, covering lots of it, so you couldn't tell what it was just by looking. Once in a while, in the mornings, I would see a man in a wheelchair sitting there in the middle of his stuff. And he had his back to the road and his face right up against the wall of the overpass. His wheelchair was parked right up against the wall. I would watch for him in the evenings when I went home, but I never saw him then. Where does he go during the day, I wondered? Where does he find all that stuff? And how does he get it back to that spot? And how does he make that pile so high out from his wheelchair? And it occurred to me that maybe the wheelchair was one of his finds rather than something that he needed medically. And that's just where he sat. What does he eat? Where does he sleep? Make sure nobody bothers him. He couldn't possibly sleep on that sidewalk with the road right there, could he? And I wondered how or even if a person like me could or should enter his life. It's a serious thing to enter into somebody else's life uninvited. Early this week, in the middle of the night, as I was driving home from the airport after I got back from General Assembly, I noticed that the little junk empire that I had been paying attention to for so many months was gone. While I was away, somebody had removed that man's property, and I wonder now what became of him, where he went next. I keep my eyes open for him, but I have not seen him since then. Years ago, my son and some of his friends lucked into an opportunity to live in this beautiful, spacious old home for part of a year. It was fully furnished, lots of room. The rent was real low. This group of friends was delighted about this house. The disadvantage was that it was in a pretty depleted area. I drove through what some people would call a fairly rough neighborhood on my way to visit my son. And one day I passed by a house many decades past its prime, run down and piled in the sidewalk. Everything. Mattress, chairs, table, pillows, lamps, big jagged pile. A thin, bent, elderly woman was walking around it slowly, just staring, just pacing and staring. Once she stood still and put her hand up over her mouth like that and then just kept right on circling. When I got to my son's house, I told them what I had seen, and they knew. Yeah, they evicted her this afternoon. It was pretty sad. I decided that I would have to stop on my way home if she was still out there, although I had no idea what I would say or what I would do. Remember, it's a serious thing to enter into somebody else's life uninvited. But when I went past the house the second time, the woman was gone. These people don't live in a war-torn country on the other side of the world, and they don't even live in flood-ravaged New Orleans. These are my actual, literal neighbors. When their most basic needs, food, shelter, love, friendship, care of some kind, when those basic needs are not met, they cannot be whole. And although I don't have any idea how I could act on behalf of either of those individual children of God, I know that the power, wisdom, energy, and good spirit of my chosen faith can make Unitarian Universalism an agent for transformation in this world. We cannot leap right in and change everything that we do right now, not yet. You've heard me say that it's a serious thing to enter somebody else's life uninvited. First, transformation has to take place very deep in our collective thinking. And that takes time, and that takes such intention. We Unitarian Universalists, from our place of privilege, are free from the need to figure out how to eat and find shelter day to day. And that makes us free for being the agents of this transformation. We don't have to change our intellects. That wouldn't be that hard. We already know intellectually that everybody is entitled to food and shelter and love. We know that. The transformation toward which we can strive runs deeper. It requires us to confront what we know for sure. And imagine that phrase in quotation marks. What is it that we know for sure? Beyond the point where we make decisions, beyond the point where our intellects factor in. Why do people live under bridges in 21st century Richmond, Virginia, or in the woods in Williamsburg, Virginia, where we have enough places for people to live and we have enough food for people to eat? Why? It is possible that long conversations with lots of people throughout the state would reveal that we know, and here again, in quotation marks, we know that homeless people get that way because they are alcoholics or drug addicts or they are mentally ill. Somehow or another, they didn't do right. And if only they were strong enough or smart enough, they would fix themselves. We know, quotation marks, that some people have more money than they need and some people have less money than they need, and that's because we deserve that and they don't, or something like that. How did we learn those things? And what can teach all of us collectively, our collective conscience, what can make that different? Transformation takes a long time. It does, a long time. And it takes serious intention, and it is so difficult. I'm not trying to tell you this is easy. We are blessed as people of privilege with the freedom, though, to engage the process and call others to engage with us in this interdependent web of which we are inextricably a part. We're probably the most advantaged creatures of all. Certainly more advantaged than any plants or animals in the respect that we can pretty much do to them what we want and they can't stop us. More advantaged than most of the humans in the world. What an enormous gift. What an enormous responsibility. In the Christian sacred text in the New Testament book of Matthew, chapter 28, verse 16, that's where the story starts. It's referred to as the Great Commission. What's happening here is Jesus has been executed. He has been resurrected, and he's back with his followers, and they recognize him, and they know who he is. They can't believe that it's him, naturally, but they do know, understand. Jesus' teaching and ministry are now in the hands of these disciples, and this is an example of why I heartily recommend the reading of the Christian sacred text. It is such an amazing book. I don't mean to be disrespectful, but you hear stories about these disciples, and we are so much better off than they are. We can take heart knowing how, no matter how unprepared we feel for ministering to the world, we have so many advantages over the ones that Jesus picked. It's just an amazing thing. He had choices, and he picked these guys. And I don't mean to be unkind, but they are dorks. They do not get it all throughout the story. You know, he's constantly explaining things to them that they don't get. The text, the Gospels are full of examples of how dense they are, and yet he trusted them with this great commission. They got nothing on us, and he trusted them. He's back with them only for a short time. They know it's him, and yet they have doubts. The text says that. They doubt it. We Unitarian Universalists can surely sympathize with that. We know a lot about doubt. But Jesus is about to be gone from the world in this story, and he tells the disciples, it's your job now, the ministry. It's your job to go forth Make disciples of all the nations, he tells them. These poor chumps. He doesn't say they have to be good at it. He doesn't say they have to be ready for it. He doesn't say they have to be successful 100% of the time. He says, tell the good news. Tell it everywhere. Tell it to everybody. Turn everybody's heart. And he knows that's impossible. And they know that's impossible. And they do it anyway. It's in your hands, he says. Jesus has given these average doubting guys this impossible job. He sends them into the world and he frees them up to bring transformation that can never really fully emerge. What I should say is not yet. Not yet has it fully emerged. He believes they'll embrace this ministry the best they can, no matter how limited that might be, and he reassures them. He makes a tender and powerful promise. This is the words. It's verse 20. And remember, I am with you always till the end of the age. When we receive this story, we have to decide for ourselves what that I is. We all have our own names for it. Maybe spirit of life, maybe ground of being, maybe great mystery, maybe love, maybe God. But look at the promise. It is always with us till the end. Whatever efforts our freedom allows us to make toward transformation, and however impossible that transformation might seem, we never have to make those efforts alone. And the efforts are never wasted. And so may it be.